this problem, and how do we come up with a national plan that encapsulates all these different anecdotal issues that we're hearing about across the country?
And what about this tracking system that the federal government has? I mean, in a world where Google knows exactly where every individual is based on the on their smartphone and their GPS, what is the tracking system that the federal government is using? Is it relying on the states once the doses are delivered to let them know what's happened, or is it continuing to track the vaccine shipments?
I think this is one of the biggest stories right now, and sort of an underreported issue, is the lack of concrete, reliable, comprehensive data at the federal government level. So the way that the federal government tracks the vaccine distribution, they rely on a slew of different streams of data, including state data.
Erin, we have 20 seconds.
Data from Tiberius, which is the Pentagon tracking system, but there are lags in reporting, and the data that they're looking at is just not reliable enough to understand what the issue is. And so that's what they're working on now. How do we get better data so we can diagnose the issue?
Erin Vanko, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will link to your piece, Millions of Vaccine Doses Are MIA, Feds Aren't Sure Why. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask, stay safe.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police have released the name of the driver who struck 10 people, killing one in southeast Portland on Monday. President Biden signed multiple executive orders today that climate experts say are the first of their kind in 10 years, and Enrique Tarrio, leader of the Proud Boys, has a past working as an informant for the FBI. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 796 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 139,355. Health officials also reported 22 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,904. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 195, followed by Clackamas County with 100. As of Sunday, about 308,000 doses of the vaccine have been administered across Oregon. Meanwhile, some critics of the vaccine rollout worry that tens of thousands of healthcare workers and people with disabilities could be left out due to Governor Kate Brown's push for educators to receive the vaccine. 12,000 vaccines are earmarked for teachers, leaving only 3,000 for healthcare workers and those with disabilities. Health officials say eligible residents can sign up to receive the vaccine online on the Oregon Health Authority's website. There's also a tool on the website to help figure out if you are eligible. However, Governor Brown continued to urge caution in a statement on Tuesday, saying, quote, "Until vaccines are widely available with high participation rates, the surest way to lower our risk and open our businesses and communities is to continue practicing the measures we know are effective in reducing the spread of COVID-19. Wear your mask, keep physical distance from others, avoid gatherings, wash your hands often, and stay home when you are sick," end quote. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 25 million cases of COVID-19. At least 427,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 172,000 cases per day. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 100 million people in nearly every country. At least 2 million people have died across the world. Early Monday afternoon in southeast Portland, Oregon City resident Paul Rivas killed one person and injured 9 others after he struck them with his vehicle. A witness saw him run into 77-year-old Jean Gerich, then make a U-turn and hit her again, dragging her. Gerich was taken to a hospital where she died of blunt force trauma. After hitting the last pedestrian and ramming another vehicle, Rivas fled his car and ran towards 17th Avenue, where neighbors surrounded him until police arrived. Rivas was convicted on charges of voyeurism in March of 2019 and has an active protection order against him in Clark County. Court documents say he suffers from anxiety and depression, which he claims were diagnosed during his time in the Secret Service. Rivas is facing charges of second-degree murder, 6 counts of second-degree assault, and 7 other charges, with his bail set at over $1.5 million. Vigils for the murdered Jean Gerich were held yesterday on Stark Street, where people placed signs, flowers, candles, and Buddha statues in her honor. A proposed bill in Oregon will require electronics manufacturers to provide tools and manuals for people to repair their products, and advocates say that'll help families out during the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Advocates for the right to repair electronics say a bill in the Oregon legislature could help families during the pandemic. House Bill 2698 would require electronics manufacturers to provide tools and manuals necessary to repair their devices to independent providers. Many manufacturers say these tools are intellectual property and only allow authorized retailers to handle repairs. State Representative Janine Solomon says Oregon's right to repair bill has support from both parties.
Once someone buys the product, they should own it, and they should be able to do whatever they want with it. Intentionally limiting access to where and how people can fix what they own means they truly don't own it.
Solomon says the bill also would reduce the cost for fixing these products. She says this is especially crucial during the pandemic, when electronics use is up and more necessary than ever to many people's lives. According to the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, this bill could save Oregon households up to $330 per year. When the pandemic began, the Oregon Department of Education found more than 75,000 students were in need of computers for distance learning. Hillary Shohoney heads FreeGeek, a Portland-based nonprofit that repairs and recycles old electronics. She says the state's digital divide was starkly visible at her organization in those early months.
The tools and really the parts were not available to us to repair the devices that we were getting in. And so at the exact same time that the community need really spiked, FreeGeek ran into the challenge of not being able to serve as many people as we wanted to and who truly had the need.
Supporters say the bill also could help cut down on electronic waste, the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Lawmakers in 13 other states also are considering right to repair legislation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
In a wide-ranging set of climate executive orders signed today, President Biden instructed the government to pause and review all oil and gas drilling on federal land, as well as eliminate fossil fuel subsidies for big oil corporations. He also plans to transform the government's fleet of nearly 650,000 cars and trucks into electric vehicles. The review of oil and gas drilling opens a path to banning all new drilling on federal land, which would reduce U.S. carbon emissions by an estimated 280 million tons a year. The Biden administration will also install climate as an essential element of U.S. foreign policy and national security, with a new goal of conserving 30% of American land and oceans by 2030. He will also craft a stronger national emissions reduction target, with specifics to be presented at an international climate summit planned for Earth Day on April 22nd of this year. For the first time ever, the White House will have an Office of Domestic Climate Policy to coordinate the government's climate agenda, as well as a national climate task force comprised of 21 government agency leaders. Gene Karpinski is the president of the League of Conservation Voters. Karpinski commended the Biden administration today, saying, quote, "This is the single biggest day for climate action in more than a decade, and what makes it all the better is that President Biden and Vice President Harris are just getting started." Washington State is incorporating environmental justice for communities of color into its lawmaking. We go again to Eric Tegedoff for more with this story.
A measure in the Washington legislature would make justice for all communities the bedrock of environmental policies in the state. The Healthy Environment for All, or HEAL Act, would incorporate environmental justice for communities of color and frontline communities into law. Guillermo Rogel is with the group Front and Centered, which is leading the effort on the HEAL Act. He says the bill would guide the state as it confronts climate change.
The communities who have been most impacted by pollution are going to be at the forefront of the decision-making process and helping ensure that investments go to the communities who are most impacted. And so that's where we needed this piece of legislation in order to put that into Washington state statute.
Rogel says the federal government has a definition for the term environmental justice, but supporters of the HEAL Act want to see Washington state go further. The bill had a public hearing last week. Rogel expects lawmakers will hold an executive session on it in the next week or two. Australia Hernandez-Cosby is a promotora, or community organizer, for Community to Community Development, who testified on behalf of farm workers in support of the HEAL Act. She says the state is falling short protecting farm workers from environmental hazards. She believes the bill is a way to hold the government accountable.
The HEAL Act is a tool to engage community, those who are most impacted by the environmental changes, to improve their health and lives for everyone. And we owe it to our farm workers to have a voice at the table.
Rogel says the comprehensiveness of the bill is unique.
We're talking about programming, we're talking about implementation, we're talking about enforcement. All of the things that state agencies do, we want to embed it and make sure that environmental justice is there.
Environmental justice groups still are waiting on a final draft of the bill, which is Senate Bill 5141. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Last summer, a D.C. Circuit Court judge ruled that the Dakota Access Pipeline was operating illegally, and now the Sioux Tribe is formally calling for its shutdown. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Whether the Dakota Access Pipeline continues to operate is now a question for President Joe Biden as well as federal courts. The D.C. Court of Appeals has ruled that the pipeline is operating illegally without a full environmental impact study. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has asked a D.C. circuit judge to issue a permanent injunction. Victoria Wicks has more.
A D.C. circuit judge ordered last summer that the Dakota Access Pipeline had to be shut down and drained by August 5th. DAPL operators and the Army Corps of Engineers immediately appealed and successfully asked for the shutdown to be reversed while the appeals court reviewed the case. That court has now confirmed that the Army Corps illegally permitted the pipeline in 2017 under former President Donald Trump, who put a halt to environmental studies ordered by the Obama administration. Jan Hasselman of Earth Justice represents the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. He says the tribe has already started the process of getting a court-ordered injunction in the D.C. Circuit, but he says the change in presidential administrations opens another avenue.
We're calling on the Biden administration to shut this pipeline down until these legal problems can be resolved.
Hasselman says the appellate court confirms that the pipeline should not have been built. It never went through the stringent review required by the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, and as a result, it is now operating without a permit.
Should the pipeline be allowed to operate while the environmental review is going on? And the only answer to that question, the only possible answer, is no. That's not the way the law works. You're not supposed to build first and study later.
The D.C. courts say the Army Corps failed to consider the hazards of running a pipeline through the waters of the Owyhee Reservoir, which tribes rely on for drinking, hunting, fishing, industry, agriculture, and cultural practices. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Fairbanks, Alaska Native community recently gathered for a vigil to increase awareness about missing people. Families shared stories, thanked those who are helping search for answers, and called for new action. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Eight individuals, including five Alaska Native people, have been missing in the Fairbanks area since last May. In the latest case, 54-year-old Stephen Jellum of Stevens Village was last seen leaving his sister Lori's apartment in Fairbanks January 9th. Lori Jellum spoke at the vigil.
We know all of you are hurting for your family, and so are we. I just want to thank everybody for being here and helping us.
There's talk on social media that the missing may be victims of a serial killer. Former Tanana Chiefs Conference Village Public Safety Officer Program Coordinator Jody Potts, who helped organize the vigil, said the number of missing is unusually high.
We don't want to make any assumptions that any of these missing person cases are connected somehow,
But we also don't want to make any assumptions that they're not connected. And so with that, that's why we are asking to create a Fairbanks Missing Persons Task Force.
There were also calls for the FBI to be brought in and for more public transparency about the status of investigations. Police, city officials, and Native leaders plan to meet to discuss the situation. Meantime, Potts urged people to look out for one another.
If you see someone in a vulnerable position, check on them. Don't just keep going. Stay aware. Watch over each other. Masit. Be safe.
For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, debunking COVID-19. At 5:45, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be overcast with some showers and a low near 40 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 49. Today in history, in 2020, Lena Benmeni died at the age of 36. Known as the Tunisian Girl, she used her blog to expose brutal violence against protesters in Tunisia in a revolt that led to her government's overthrow and the Arab Spring. The quote of the day is from Meni, who wrote on her blog in 2010, quote, "Because the government is indifferent to the troubles of its citizens, we as a civil society need to take action." The leader of the Proud Boys, a far-right extremist hate group, apparently has a past working as an informant for the FBI and local law enforcement, according to a report from Reuters today. A transcript from a federal court shows that Enrique Tarrio has repeatedly worked undercover since an arrest in 2012. In the transcript, a federal prosecutor, FBI agent, as well as Tarrio's own lawyer detail his undercover work and say he helped authorities prosecute more than a dozen people in various cases. In an interview on Tuesday, Tarrio said, quote, "I don't know any of this. I don't recall any of this." The Proud Boys were deeply involved in the January 6th insurrection against the Capitol, so the revelation is startling to many because it shows a leader of a far-right hate group under intense scrutiny was, at least at one time, actively collaborating with criminal investigators. Tarrio was arrested upon arriving in Washington, D.C. on January 4th, 2 days before the riot. D.C.'s Superior Court ordered him to leave the city, pending his court date later this year. In other interviews, Tarrio has revealed that before Proud Boys rallies, he would often inform police of their plans. Amidst the backdrop of police involvement in the insurrection and with the second death by suicide of a police officer reported today, there are still many questions about how the many failures led up to January 6th. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael didn't think deja vu would come this quickly.
It's senatorial deja vu. One Democrat like Leahy of Vermont gets ill and is replaced by a Republican. There goes the possible 50-50 as Mitch maintains his stranglehold on our future and a Trump-appointed judge delays Biden's ban on deportations. I didn't get my hopes up with Biden as much as I did with Obama, knowing step one was dumping Trump, but as with Obama, hope alone gets you nowhere. Another deja vu. What's not deja vu is COVID, whose constant growth has become less news and more frightening, while the economy, or more accurately, the absence of one, despairs us further, while continuing to erode our social bonds, weakened by isolation and fear, one downward spiral after another, making the country, if not the world, one big tornado alley. Maybe someday, not too far in the future, we'll be making decent money, have affordable rent, be able to hang out with friends and family and say, "Hey, I think this all has happened before." For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The Senate is moving forward with Trump's impeachment trial as scholars question the legality of impeachment after an official leaves office. With more on the story, we go to Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are tracking our democracy in historic times.
The theory that the Senate can't try former officials would amount to a constitutional get-out-of-jail-free card for any president who commits an impeachable offense.
Senate Majority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer and other members rebuffed a Republican effort to dismiss the article of impeachment against former President Donald Trump. More than 150 law scholars wrote a letter to affirm its legality. But Professor Rory Little at UC Hastings College of Law says it's an open question.
There's a good argument that maybe this is a more important question than just a procedural question and should be answered by the Supreme Court.
Chief Justice John Roberts declined to oversee the Senate trial. The justices just dismissed two suits against Trump for using his office to make money from foreign governments because the charges were very narrowly constructed. Little notes that the Supreme Court may see Trump's Senate trial as a political issue.
He will still be stained in history as the only president to be impeached twice. There seems to be some political desire to sort of fry him on the griddle of the Senate.
Just five Republicans voted in favor of the trial, which suggests a likely acquittal for Trump. After the session, presiding Senator Patrick Leahy went to the hospital out of an abundance of caution. His spokesman says he started to not feel well. A group of San Antonio Republicans has filed paperwork to form the new MAGA Patriot Party, estimating 12,000 members nationwide. A CNN review of Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's past social media revealed her campaign's likes for posts suggesting executing Democratic politicians. In a tweet, the Republican who had argued against election results said other people have managed her pages in the past, but she did not specifically deny the likes. Democrats introduced a bill yesterday to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. The risk benefits of past increases are well documented, but opponents say it's still a job killer. The federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 since 2009. The White House is seeking 200 million additional doses of COVID-19 vaccines, enough to supply all adults in the U.S. by the end of summer. President Joe Biden also announced executive actions yesterday to address racial equity. A direct response to the protests that erupted after Minnesota police shot and killed George Floyd, an unarmed black man. Representative Chuy Garcia of Illinois introduced a sweeping immigration reform bill yesterday.
At this moment in history, we're called to uphold our values of compassion, common humanity, and racial justice.
Co-sponsor Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington says it focuses on people who cross the border seeking safety, opportunity, and freedom.
There is simply no need to be prosecuting, detaining, and deporting those who are seeking refuge in a nation of immigrants and refugees from all over the world.
The bill complements Biden's executive order mandating a 100-day freeze on deportations, though a U.S. district judge granted Texas a temporary restraining order against the moratorium. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
While President Biden took a series of actions to promote racial equity yesterday, a Trump-appointed judge in Texas temporarily blocked the administration's 100-day stop on deportations. Last week, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued over the deportation moratorium, requesting that the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Texas intervene. And District Judge Drew Tipton did intervene yesterday. He issued a 14-day temporary restraining order that blocks the policy nationwide and will remain in effect until he has considered a motion for a preliminary injunction. Tipton said that Biden's halt of deportations would violate an immigration law requiring people with final orders of removal to be deported within 90 days. Marisa Franco is the national director for Mejente, an immigrant rights advocacy organization. Franco said of the intervention, quote, "Judge Tipton's decision to block the nationwide deportation moratorium will be remembered as one of the last gasps of the Trump administration's racist, xenophobic legacy." In related news, yesterday the Biden administration rescinded the Trump-era zero-tolerance policy for immigrants who unlawfully crossed the U.S.-Mexico border. The policy caused thousands of families to be torn apart by the U.S. government, including over 600 children who remain separated from their parents. Children's mental health is on the decline, and that was unfortunately the case even before the pandemic. Here's Suzanne Potter with more on the story.
About 1 in 6 high school students in California reported thinking about suicide in 2019, according to new findings from the nonprofit Children Now. The 2021 California County Scorecard of Children's Well-Being, released this week, is an interactive online data tool that tracks 39 indicators that measure such considerations as mental health, poverty, and academics. Ted Lempert, who heads the group Children Now, says it indicates things were already tough before the pandemic, especially for low-income children of color.
We know that all these issues have been exacerbated, so it really sounds the alarm even stronger that we need to prioritize kids and provide these supports urgently.
The report also found that more than one-third of kids report chronic sadness, and 15% are in families who don't always have enough to eat. It also pinpoints some bright spots, like high school graduation rates north of 90% in rural Mariposa, Merced, Modoc, and Sierra counties. The full report is on the Children Now website. Lempert says the data tool allows apples-to-apples comparisons among California's very diverse 58 counties.
It's especially helpful for local officials and local groups to see which counties are doing better in particular areas.
Children Now says in the counties that score the highest for kids' well-being, local government agencies tend to work more closely with community groups to make their programs as efficient, easy to use, and family-friendly as possible. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Climate change is adding pressure to degraded Everglades, which makes restoration efforts around the country even more urgent. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Florida Everglades support a rich population of wading birds, white ibis, wood storks, and spoonbills. Mark Cook of the South Florida Water Management District says the birds depend on the Everglades' alternating sawgrass ridges and sloughs.
You have these ridges and these grooves running sort of parallel to one another.
During the wet season, water covers much of the marsh, and fish spawn across a wide area. But during the dry season, the water recedes, and the fish move into the sloughs. For the birds,
what that does is actually concentrating the prey into higher densities.
So they have easy pickings right when they need to feed their growing chicks. But Cook warns that climate change could alter the landscape and make it harder for the birds to forage. Warm, dry conditions could make the sawgrass ridges dry out and collapse, flattening the marsh. The sloughs would then fill with cattails instead of fish. The Everglades are already degraded by urban development and agriculture, which have interrupted the flow of water across the landscape.
So a major goal of restoration is getting that water back into the Everglades.
And Cook says climate change makes this restoration especially urgent. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, bringing you the latest news in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Fortress on a Hill, a new show discussing foreign policy predictions for 2021 and beyond. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news with your host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Between the Covers, which features interviews with locally and nationally known authors. Then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, with an interview with independent animator Nina Paley, who reimagines mythology through a feminist lens. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Noise Filter, debunking COVID-19. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
The following is the first of a series on the new vaccines that are rolling out. So we're going to do part one now, and we're going to do part two in the next day or so. So this is a story that Doc Griggs had been asking one of our writers to do, which is going to be a summary of the vaccines. So I want to give a huge shout out to our writer, Karen, who is in her internship, doing a surgery internship at Tulane University. So for her to take the time to do something like this is amazing. Mm-hmm. So we're very grateful for her. And also we're very lucky because we actually have her in studio today.
Hopefully
she will jump on and say a couple words about her writing project here. So getting started. Now, hospitals around the country have started distributing the COVID vaccine. Yay, we are very excited about that. This is super fantastic news. And we at COVID Noise Filter are very excited and hopeful that this will be the beginning of the end of the pandemic. Now that the vaccines are rolling out, we wanted to take some time to discuss how these vaccines are unique and what that means for distribution as well as access, Doc.
So as of right now, there are three main vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. Two of these, Pfizer and Moderna, have FDA approval for emergency use, and those both require two doses spaced a couple of weeks apart. One's 3 weeks, one's 4 weeks. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine will complete its clinical trial in January and will likely receive FDA approval soon after. It's only expected to require one dose.
That's right, Doc Griggs. Now, I've got a bunch of questions that I've been getting from friends, family, as well as from listeners from COVID Noise Filter. So why don't we just dive right into them and start to answer them?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. So one of the questions that's actually been trending on Google is, can I get the coronavirus from the vaccine, Doc?
Well, I guess it means that's a question on a lot of people's minds, so let's answer it.
Okay.
The short answer is no.
Right.
This type of vaccine doesn't work like those in the past. For instance, like the polio vaccine, where it could potentially be reactivated and infect people, these vaccines are made totally differently.
That's right. So what do you mean by that?
So the old vaccines used the whole virus to prompt our cells to gain immunity to them.
Okay.
These viruses were usually inactivated or dead.
Okay.
However, sometimes in rare circumstances, they could be reactivated and can make people really sick or even spread the virus.
So how is this one particularly different?
Well, the COVID vaccines that we have now use only a little piece of the virus to help create immunity. Actually, it's some pretty new technology, right? Well, sort of.
So we're talking about the mRNA, right?
Yeah, not the virus itself, but the messenger RNA.
The messenger RNA. Right, okay.
Yeah, so messenger RNA in of itself, it's not a new idea or discovery. It's been around for a while. In fact, almost every cell in our own bodies have working messenger RNA, and we've known of its existence, and scientists have been working on it for decades.
Right. Now, in our cells, the DNA gets copied into a molecule of mRNA, and that's used as a blueprint to make proteins. In other words, you can't just take the whole DNA and copy the whole DNA. You have to copy small portions of the DNA.
Right.
And that small portion is made up of what we refer to as mRNA. The M in mRNA stands for messenger. So it's basically a negative imprint of the, or a negative copy. So if you take your hand and put it into a plate of clay, and then you pull your hand out, that's your copy of your hand in that clay, but it's a negative imprint. That's what mRNA is. So Dr. Griggs, explain to me how this is used in new technology.
So it's an old concept being used in a new way. COVID is a virus that uses RNA as its genetic material, as opposed to DNA. So what the vaccine does, it takes a small, tiny part of the mRNA, the messenger RNA, of the genetic material of the virus.
Okay, so then our body makes antibodies against the virus RNA. So what you're saying then, Dr. Griggs, is that the mRNA codes for the protein.
Which is the spikes, right?
That's the spikes. That's they call it a coronavirus, right? That means crown, right?
Yeah, like the crown of my... Yeah, yeah.
Don't use your
stop, man. Just stop.
Here, look at it. When I spike my hair up, yeah, that's more of a crown. So those are the spikes. So that we refer to that as an antigen, right? Mm-hmm, so, so what happens is that the mRNA basically codes for the spike protein that the virus uses, because the virus has genetic material, of course, that codes for that spike protein. So scientists went in there, they figured out what that code was for the spike protein. They chemically, or they in the lab, they basically reproduced it. They put it in this lipid protein envelope, and then that's the vaccine. So what happens, the mRNA gets taken up by the muscle cells, and then it goes through the cellular machinery of the cell.
Not even in the nucleus. So it's not even changing anyone's DNA or genetic material. It goes into the cytoplasm, where this machinery, right?
Right.
The ribosomes.
The ribosome. The 3D printer.
The 3D printer.
Of the cell.
Manufacturing these spikes.
Right.
And our bodies become little spike factories, and as a consequence, we make antibodies, right?
That's right. In fact, it's about as organic gets, right? Because you're using your body's own cellular machinery and ingredients to make that spike protein, and then that spike protein gets pushed to the wall or to the surface of the cell. It penetrates through the surface of the cell, and then it gets into the bloodstream, where now an immune response is made. So this this vaccine then is both an antigen producing vaccine, and it produces an immune
response. That's
amazing.
So So the vaccine basically turns our machinery into this protein making machinery that we call antigens that elicits immune response.
So why do this rather than just using the proteins itself? In other words, all other vaccines would have just injected the antigen directly into you.
Yeah, but this is it's much more cost effective. There are more resources available. The messenger RNA vaccines are easiest to produce. So in the race to the vaccine, it's how many companies chose to go about it. Once the virus's genetic code was discovered back in January, companies had the tools they needed to make an mRNA vaccine. Even though Johnson & Johnson used a different method that we'll talk about later, the availability of the code versus having to actually grow an actual virus wait and try to extract out a specific protein is the difference is exponential.
That's right. So it's much faster to make. So why is this the first time that we're seeing them?
Well, it's because mRNA is fairly unstable. You can ask any biology bench worker. When we say that, someone that's actually works under the hood, cultured viruses and cultured different cells. Anyone that's worked with them in the past, you know, cells can be kind of finicky.
That's right.
And when we get to the smaller portions of them, they can even be even more finicky. We even have proteins on our own skin that can break down mRNA. So it takes a long time to get what you need in order to create a vaccine.
Right. So one of the things that I often refer to is I refer to mRNA, once it gets into the cell, at least through this vaccine, as kind of being like the Snapchat of genetic material.
Uh-oh, folks.
That's right. Look, did you hear me? I laid it down. 52-year-old dude right here knows what Snapchat is. I even know what the filters are that are on Snapchat. Boy. And just like on Snapchat, the Snapchat lasts like 30 seconds and then it disappears. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens with this mRNA. Mm-hmm. It just disappears. As soon as it's used, it's gone. So this is one of the reasons why we don't see a lot of effects.
So one of the questions a lot of people have, if that's the case, it only lasts for 30 seconds and it's unstable, why is it that we can use it now then?
Well, because the companies have found success in using mRNA, and they've had to include molecules that help stabilize the mRNA until it's actually done its job. And those agents are part of the differences between two very similar vaccines.
Which would be Pfizer and Moderna. Again, we'll get to J&J later. Overextended health departments ask infected individuals to contact trace for themselves.
What? Isn't that what contact tracers are for?
Yeah, this is going to be a doozy.
Right.
Following the fall surge in COVID-19 cases, many local health departments have found their contact tracers overwhelmed and resorted to asking infected residents to trace for themselves. Contact tracing, as we know, is essential to preventing the spread of COVID-19. It keeps those who have been exposed informed and away from those who have not.
That's right. In the spring, when the U.S. began sheltering in place, relatively small groups of contact tracers were sufficient for the caseload, as most infected individuals had been in contact with a limited number of people. Now, as people started to gather more regularly, the number of cases to investigate has increased, and the process of contact tracing has now become more complicated. In fact, I would argue at this point, very difficult, if not impossible.
So who have you been in contact with? Nobody.
Right.
Wait, what? No one? You mean you contracted this disease and you hadn't been in contact with anyone?
That's right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the number? Yeah, exactly. 454-4554. The contact tracing workforce in the U.S. has grown in the past months to meet a consistently increasing demand, but has not yet risen to accommodate the number of cases. Because of this, some smaller health departments have stopped tracing some reported cases. They ask the infected individual to do it themselves.
That's right. So imagine being sick and then also imagine being sick with COVID.
So where'd you get it? Scooby-Doo, Smurfette, Fred Sanford. What this does is, what happened is, it allows trained contact tracers to focus on cases that require extra attention, like those cases that affect the elderly and educators. But it compromises the contact tracing processes for most positive cases, which is how it gets to the educators and the elderly. It's an unfortunate wrinkle.
Yeah. The backlog of cases has also been exacerbated by shifting CDC advisories regarding the quarantine to increase compliance in the center. And the CDC has decreased the recommended quarantine duration from 14 days to 10 without a test and 7.
Oh, and 7.
If you do have a negative test. Contact tracers had to learn and communicate these new procedures as the caseload surged.
According to ProPublica, those that contact trace themselves should contact individuals they encounter for 15 minutes. Now, Doc, do this math with me. Those that are infected themselves need to contact those individuals they've encountered for 15 minutes within 6 feet for 48 hours before they began to experience symptoms. Are you taking notes?
Yeah. My head is starting to...
Do you have a cough?
No, I'm good.
Just checking. And when they contact these people, they need to inform them that you've tested positive and believe that there is a chance that they might have been exposed. You also should encourage them to limit their exposure for 10 days and to get tested if they begin to experience symptoms. Have I done a great job at complicating something to confuse you, an infectious disease doctor, an epidemiologist?
That's right. I mean, we're being somewhat tongue-in-cheek here, and this is something that's so serious. And it is sad that we've reached a point now in these United States of America where we have to now do our own contact tracing. There are so many other ways, so many other things that could have been done that could have avoided this. And just the fact that now we have a story where people are being asked to contact trace themselves and report that to the state is just another example of just how poorly we did as a country.
Yeah, folks, if a contact tracer calls you, please cooperate.
Pick up the phone.
And pick up the phone and then tell them the truth.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenna Yokoyama, and I'm also one of KBOO's interim station co-managers. News from the Boo is a show where we talk about everything KBOO, talking about news for our volunteers, our members, our listeners, anyone who wants to know about what's going on in KBOO. So first, I'm going to start off with an interview with KBOO's interim program director, Asia Hawthorne, and she and I got on the Zoom today and talked about special programming that we have coming up over the next few months and how our volunteer programmers can get involved. So Asia, we have some special programming coming up in February and March, and that's what you are here to talk to us about. So Asia, tell us what's coming up.
We're doing a bunch of special programming, lots of music marathons and various themes. First coming up, we got African-American and Black History Month for next month. Every Tuesday of February between 7 and 8, Public Affairs Department is putting together special content. All right, so on February 12th, KBOO will be simulcasting with WRHU Hofstra University in celebration of World Radio Day and in dedication to our late engineer volunteer, Mark Wiener. Those of you that don't know Mark, he was a really big pillar in our engineering department. So we're really honored that they invited us to be a part of this. For the first half of the simulcast, they're going to interview a volunteer about working with Mark and all the things that he's done over here at KBOO. And then the second half of the simulcast, they're going to interview a volunteer about KBOO and the community. And we're going to drop in some clips made by volunteers and programmers to showcase Portland. The theme for their World Radio Day is going to be Passport Radio. So if you guys are interested in submitting a clip, please reach out to program@kboo.org. Slots are limited, so please reach out.
So just real quick, what kind of clips what is like the topic or what kind of things are you looking for in a clip?
Yes.